You're listening to DTFHN for August 20th, 2026. I'm your open source and unpatched host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website what at the article, and the article never sees it coming. Today's a good day for looking inside things that were never supposed to open. Bring a blade and some patience. Let's cut in. What if the reason a pasted answer feels wrong has nothing to do with the answer being wrong? There's a site making the rounds called Don't Paste the AI. The argument fits on a napkin. Someone asks you a question. You feed it to a chatbot, copy what comes back, send it along. Fast, helpful feeling. And the person on the other end has the exact same model open in the exact same browser. If they wanted 4 seconds of generic, they had 4 seconds of generic. They came to you for the part the model doesn't have. Your context, your taste, your judgment about which of the 11 plausible answers is the one that actually applies here. That's a good argument. It's also, and I say this with affection, an argument about manners. Which is where it gets funny. Because the thing being complained about is abundance. For most of history, written explanation was expensive. Someone spending 4 paragraphs on your question meant something. It cost them time, and the time was the signal. That signal is now free. Anyone can generate 4 paragraphs about anything, instantly, forever. And the reaction is not celebration. The reaction is a website politely asking people to stop. The commenters get somewhere sharper than the essay does. One points out that half their colleagues send messages like X broken with zero context. And since the AI showed up, those same people finally write something legible. Another names the real machine. A corporate culture where one badly phrased message can cost you a reputation. So everyone launders everything through a model that softens it into paste. That's not an AI problem. That's a fear problem wearing an AI costume. Another observes that pasting the output verbatim is sometimes the correct response to someone offloading their thinking onto you. An honest signal that says, I ran this through the machine because that's all your question deserves. And my favorite, someone reads the essay and concludes it was written by AI because the metaphors don't land. We have arrived at the stage where the sermon against slop is itself suspected of slop. Nobody can tell anymore. Nobody. Here's the question. Nobody in that thread asks. If the model's answer is genuinely better than yours. More accurate, more complete, more useful. Why exactly should you send yours instead? The honest answer is that judgment is still scarce, even when text isn't. Knowing which output to trust, which to discard, which one fits this person's actual situation. That's the work. That was always the work. The typing was never the work. So don't paste the AI, rate it, decide if it's right, and then say what you think. Now a story where nobody's arguing about whether the tool works. They're arguing about what it means. Windows. Story 2. There's a genuine collector's item sitting in some of your closets right now, and it's a naked baby. Windows diff with an anti-Percy hologram on the side of the box. The photographer used his own infant son as the model, because human faces are extraordinarily hard to counterfeit. The eye catches the wrongness instantly. Tilt the box, and the baby's arm rises, pointing at a monitor that blooms into the Windows logo. Sweet, clever. A tiny piece of optical engineering doing security work. Then, a government complained. The baby wasn't wearing a shirt. He was framed from the waist up. Visible torso, nothing else. And the objection was that he was therefore presumably naked below frame. Microsoft reprinted the hologram. New version, shirt, overalls. But the reprint was a rush job, so they dropped the arm animation entirely. The kid points at nothing now. That's the part worth sitting with. The animation was the whole reason the hologram existed as a piece of craft. It was the thing that made it delightful, and it was cut because a censorship complaint about imagined pants ran on a shipping deadline. The offense was inferred, not depicted, and the engineering paid for it anyway. Raymond Chen catalogs the rest. Windows XP's original desert wallpaper. Pulled because testers saw buttocks in a landscape, a generic user account icon. Pulled because someone saw Hitler, a cartoon figure in the Switch user dialogue. Pulled at a government's insistence because it resembled an obscene body part, and Chen's favorite, people finding hidden images in the cloud's bitmap. Their clouds, nature's Rorschach test. Consider what this means structurally. Every one of those changes was a single vendor receiving a complaint through a channel nobody else could see, silently altering what millions of desktops looked like. No public record of who objected, no version anyone could fork back to. When the shipping artifact is closed, the revision history is closed too. The naked baby hologram survives as a rumor and a handful of boxes in attics, not as a commit you can check out. Compare that to how it works when the assets live in the open. Someone objects, the argument happens in a thread, the change lands or it doesn't. And either way, the old version is still sitting there in the history for anyone who wants it. The complaint becomes part of the record instead of replacing it. Go check your box. The shirtless one is rarer. So what else is sitting in a box you can't inspect? Story 3. AliExpress, a hidden audio fingerprint, and the Bluetooth headphones that started acting weird because of it. Somebody's Bluetooth headphones started dropping their PC connection whenever an AliExpress tab was open, not playing a video, not clicking anything, just open. Here's the mechanism. Strip down. Web audio. The browser API for generating and analyzing sound has a fingerprinting trick attached to it. You ask the browser to render a short audio buffer, never route it to a speaker, and measure the floating point output. Different hardware, different audio stacks, different rounding. The resulting numbers identify your device with unsettling precision. That's the whole technique. It's been in the tracking toolkit for years. The part nobody accounted for. Your operating system doesn't know the audio is silent. It knows an application requested an audio stream. And your headphones don't know either. Multipoint Bluetooth works by arbitrating between two connected devices. Whichever one is producing audio wins the channel. So a hidden fingerprinting routine that produces zero audible sound still looks to every layer below the browser. Like a device that started playing something. Your headphones dutifully switch. Your PC audio dies. There's a comment from someone whose car stereo interpreted the background at AliExpress app as an incoming voice command. Strip away the framing, and the actual constraint is this. Audio output is unpermissioned. Camera, microphone, location, notifications. All gated behind a prompt. Audio just runs. Nobody gated it because nobody imagined silent audio as a capability worth requesting. And now the tracking industry has an ungated hardware identification channel sitting in every browser. What makes this diagnosable at all is the open part of the stack. Someone could open DevTools, watch the audio context get instantiated, correlate it with the Bluetooth state change, and write it up. The browser's behavior is inspectable. The multipoint spec is documented. The person who found this could reason from observable layers all the way down to the arbitration logic in their headphones. Compare the iOS AP version of the same symptom, same tracking, same audio session, and the only available diagnostic is, kill the app, does the car stereo stop freaking out? That's not debugging. That's superstition with a control group. The fix is boring and correct. Treat audio output as a permission, the way we already treat every other hardware channel. It'll take a spec discussion and a couple of browser releases. Meanwhile, the bug report exists publicly, because the layer where it happened was open enough to look at. Now 4, something with zero superstition involved. Story 4, OpenRouter is joining Stripe, and this one's a genuinely fun piece of infrastructure news. I built a routing layer once that was supposed to be neutral. Pick the cheapest healthy backend, fail over when one degrades. 6 months in, one backend was getting 80% of traffic. Not because it was better, but because a latency threshold I'd hard-coded happened to match its median response time. Nobody chose that. The architecture chose it. That's the thing to hold in your head while reading this. OpenRouter. The Motto marketplace routing 10 trillion tokens a day across 400 Motto is joining Stripe. And the engineering here genuinely deserves respect. They abstracted a chaotic, fast-moving provider landscape into one API surface, with observability, cost management, and uptime routing on top. Building a stable abstraction over an unstable substrate is hard work, and they did it well enough that 10 million developers built on it. The announcement says the mission doesn't bend to any model, any provider, or any parent company. Routing decisions stay driven by what's best for the user. I believe they mean it. Alex and the team have been consistent about this since 2023. But apply the due diligence you'd apply to any dependency. Where does the routing logic live? Close. Who can inspect the weights that decide which provider serves your request? Nobody outside. What happens if the objective functions ship? Not maliciously, just a threshold tuned for margin instead of latency. You'd never know. The commenter who said, using open in your company name should be illegal, is being glib, but there's a real question underneath it. And one commenter asked the sharpest version, how do you verify a provider is actually serving the model it claims? If a provider quietly swaps a smaller model in behind the label, what's your check? That's a verification problem that only gets solvable when the routing and attestation layer is inspectable, which is the actual opportunity. The abstraction OpenRouter proved out. One interface, many models, honest price and performance signals, is now demonstrated at $8 billion of validated demand. That's a spec. Someone can build it open. Cortex is already in that space. LightLM exists. The multi-motto future OpenRouter described is correct and worth wanting. It just shouldn't route through infrastructure. Only one company can audit. Build the open one. The blueprint just got published by acquisition. That same instinct pause, take something everyone uses and make it cleaner, shows up in the most unexpected places. Story 5, turns are better than radians. The first serious objection in the thread is a derivative. Someone points out that the derivative of sine of 2 pi x is 2 pi times cosine of 2 pi x. The constant doesn't vanish, it just moves. Another commenter goes further. Euler's formula breaks. E to the I x equals cosine x plus I sine x only works in radians. Ma pama, you'd need a new base, roughly 535.49. Both are correct. Neither is a rebuttal. And watching the thread work that out is the interesting part. Casey Muratori's claim is narrow. In actual code, a programmer has a value already periodic on 0 to 1. A phase, a progress fraction, a normalized position. They multiply it by tau because sine demands radians. Then, sine's implementation, in its first few instructions, multiplies by 1.273239, which is 4 over pi. The caller converts in. The library converts back out. 2 multiplies that cancel. Performed by 2 people who never talk to each other. He pulled the example by opening Gadda's source and searching for tau. It was the first hit. The precision argument is the one that lands hardest. 90 degrees in radians is pi over 2. Irrational, unrepresentable in any number of bits, forever approximate. 90 degrees in turns is 0.25. 0 bits of mandasa, exact. Half turn, exact. 3/4, 1 bit. The angles that appear constantly in real graphics code are precisely the ones radians handle work. Run this forward. Imagine a standard library that ships sin turn and cos turn alongside sin and cos. No conversion at the boundary. Rotations composed by adding fractions that stay exact. 1/4 turn applied 4 times returning to identity. Actually identity not identity plus epsilon accumulated across 4 irrational multiplications. Every place where a shader wraps phase with a frac call becomes free instead of nearly free. And the derivative objection resolves cleanly. The 2 pi doesn't disappear, it appears once in the calculus, where it's supposed to be. Rather than twice per frame, in opposite directions. Rather than cold, that's only trying to spin us bright. The reason this hasn't happened is that the convention is older than the hardware. Radians made sense when a human held the pencil. The libraries that could change it are open. Someone can add those 2 functions this afternoon, and the correct constant is the one that was already there. Nastora 6, go, what tongue wei tongue chun er really? In year Jothers out to do with system software research is irrelevant. His argument was that the field had calcified. Everybody was building on Unix and Windows. Nobody could ship a new idea because the cost of moving an ecosystem had become infinite. 15 years later, he co-designed Go, and the entire language was a bet against that calcification. Keep the spec small enough that it can actually change. Go EBNRZ shipped this week, and it's a good illustration of what that bat buys you. Generic methods, finally, struct literals that let you set an embedded field directly. Gopher with a burrow, no nested braces. Type inference generalized to every assignment context. So a generic function slots into a composite literal or a channel send without you spelling out the types. Run that principle to its end, though. If a struct literal key can be any valid field selector, then what happens when the outer struct and the embedded one both have a field called burrow? A commenter raised exactly this. The selector resolves by depth. Shallowest wins, which means adding a field to an outer struct can silently retarget an initialization written years earlier. The convenience and the ambiguity are the same feature. You can't have one without accepting the other, and the Go team took the trade knowingly. The part I keep admiring is quieter. Someone in the thread noticed the release notes skipped it entirely. Floating point parsing and formatting now uses Russ Cox's U-scale algorithm. Every Go program that prints a number got faster, and it didn't make the highlights. Same with size specialized allocation. Small objects under 80 bytes, 30% cheaper to allocate. Nobody writes a blog post about that. It just arrives. And crypto/MLDSA, post-quantum signatures. Valo, post-quantum signatures. FIPS, trait into X509. And TLS. Filippo Valsorda and the Go Crypto team have been pushing this for years, ahead of any mandate, ahead of any customer asking. That's a standard library treating the next 20 years as its problem. All of it public. The proposals, the arguments, The Rejected Alternatives. Readable by anyone, all the way back, Pike's complaint was that nobody could change the substrate anymore. The answer turned out to be building a substrate in the open, where the people who use it can see how it moves. Now, a very different kind of open pause story 7, where Google quietly stopped pushing Git tags for some Android source code. The obvious read is that Google is closing the door. Let me argue the other side first, because it's stronger than it looks. Android was never a community project. It was always a code drop. Google builds internally, ships a device, then throws a tarball over the wall. Nobody outside ever had commit access to the thing that actually runs on your phone, and the GPL only covers the kernel. The parts under Apache 2 carry no distribution obligation at all, so company deciding to stop pushing convenience metadata to a public mirror while still handing over kernel sources on request through a form is doing exactly what the license requires. Not a violation, barely even a change in kind, just a change in friction. One commenter in the thread says, "As much, and he's right on the law." Here's where the argument comes apart. Friction is the mechanism. It always was. A Git tag costs nothing to publish. It's a pointer. 40 bytes saying, this commit is the one that shipped. Removing it doesn't withhold code. It withholds the ability to know which code. And without that pointer, a downstream project, like Graphinose, can't reproduce a build. Can't diff a security patch against what's actually on the device. Can't verify anything. They get a pile of commits and no map. Replace an automated URL with a request form and a human in the loop. And you've converted a 2-second fetch into a relationship you can revoke. Nobody has to say no. The queue says no for you. And the compliance argument proves the opposite of what it thinks. If the minimum viable interpretation of the license is a form and a wait, then the license was never what made Android open. Practice was. Habit was. The thing that made it work was a company choosing, day after day, to make the code trivially reachable. And that choice is unilaterally reversible, which means it was never a guarantee. Which is what makes GrapheneOS interesting. They noticed in public, they kept building anyway. The Pixel kernel repos went quiet, and the work continued, because the alternative to depending on someone's goodwill is doing the reproducible build discipline yourself. The tags were never the point. Verification is the point. Build for people who can check your work. Verification is one kind of trick you can check yourself. Here's another. Turns out you can do the day-of-week calculation in your head. Faster. Division is the slowest arithmetic your processor does with integers. Addition takes a cycle. Multiplication takes a few. Integer division takes 20, 30, sometimes more. And it can't be pipelined the way the others can. That's the constraint. Everything in Benjoff's article grows out of it. Because the day of the week is a modulo problem. Days repeat every 7. Take the number of days since some fixed epoch. Divide by 7. Keep the remainder. Conceptually trivial. And it lands you on the one operation the silicon is worst at. The workaround is old and elegant. Any division by a constant can be turned into a multiplication by a reciprocal, followed by a ship. You're trading a slow, exact operation for a fast, approximate one that happens to be exact over the range you care about. Compilers already do this for you when the divisor is known. The article pushes further. Pack the answers themselves into the bits of a single integer, then shift and mask to pull out the one you want. The lookup table stops being memory. It becomes a constant sitting in a register. The commenters do what good commenters do. They find the edges. Dates before the epoch produce negative day counts, and negative modulo in most languages yields a negative remainder, which is why the fix-ups exist. The plus sevens. The second mod. Someone else notes that this is almost never the bottleneck in a real program. And they're right. And it doesn't matter. Another points to Conway's doomsday algorithm, which solves the same problem for wetware instead of silicon. Here's what I keep coming back to. One commenter said, this is what they want the web to be. A document with live visualizations, interactive, and still structurally a document. You can read it, you can view source, you can copy the constant into your own code and check whether it's right, because the derivation is on the page instead of behind a paywall or compiled into someone's proprietary date library. That's the whole thing. A technique like this only compounds if it's reachable. Publish derivation via RIF-iable arithmetic, no account required. Somebody worked out a real optimization and then made it something you could learn from rather than something you had to license. The math was always public. The choice to explain it wasn't. Now for something with considerably less elegance and considerably more chaos. Somebody bought a domain as a punchline and accidentally ended up in international politics. What if the most accurate map of a nation's artillery is one nobody meant to draw? Here's how it happened. In 2018, a guy registers sunhub.org as a joke. That's it. The domain does one thing. Redirect you to HabHub with a filter applied because HabHub's admins had started hiding weather balloons by default and the balloon-chasing crowd wanted them back. A redirect, a punchline with a registrar fee. Then, it grows the way mycelium grows. Not by design. By following nutrients. HabHub servers strain, so they proxy the ingestion. The proxy needs somewhere to put data. So there's a cluster. The cluster has data nobody's using, so they expose it. Backwards compatible AP is so the old front end keeps working. Open access via S3. Their own prediction engine. Each step is the smallest reasonable next thing, and none of them is a plan. Then, Mark builds reverse predictions. Take a radio sonde already in flight. Run the wind model backwards and you get the launch site. It works extremely well. It finds launch sites that were never properly documented anywhere. It starts finding vessels at sea. And in 2009 year, the email arrives. Sensitive military installation. We'd really prefer it not be explicitly marked on any map. The thing about wind data. It doesn't only tell you tomorrow's weather. It tells you where the shell lands. Same numbers, different question. A hobbyist tracking balloons to the ground and an artillery officer computing a firing solution are reading the identical data set. And the amateur one is better instrumented, because official software stopped tracking at some altitude and these people wanted to know where the thing actually fell. Which is how you end up fielding an insurance inquiry about a radio sonde that spooked a horse through a fence. What I find genuinely great here is the response. They didn't shut down reverse predictions. They kept the capability and delete specific sites on legitimate request. Capability stays public. The narrow exception gets handled case by case. Compare that to the transmitter vendor a commenter quotes, saying their units power down early due to, quote, strategic considerations. Secrecy baked into the hardware, unfalsifiable by design. One of these systems you can audit. The other you have to trust. The map was always derivable. Somebody just did the arithmetic in public. Now, Manabu Kosaka builds sculptures out of handmade paper. By hand, and the results are gorgeous. Story 10. Let's look. A Big Mac. sesame seeds and all, photographed in black and white. Except, it isn't a photograph and it isn't a Big Mac. It's paper. Cut by hand, layer by layer, stacked and fused until it has volume texture and the specific slumping geometry of a burger that's been sitting under a heat lamp. Manabu Kotsaka makes these. A commenter on the thread said flatly that if they didn't know what they were looking at, they'd assume it was a photo. That's the correct reaction. The method is what gets me. The first guess anyone makes. And one commenter says this outright. Is compression, some pulping technique, some mold, some clever press. It isn't. Every sheet is cut individually and laminated onto the one below it, which means the form is built the way a 3D printer builds, in slices. Except the slicing algorithm is a person with a blade deciding where the contour lives on this particular layer. There's no undo. Layer 40 is sitting on layers 1 through 39, and the whole stack is committed. Then there's the lettering. Someone in the thread asks, genuinely baffled, how you cut characters that small, not printed, not stamped. Cut. There's video of it. The tolerance a hand can hold when it has decided to hold that tolerance turns out to be substantially finer than most of us assume. And the only reason we assume otherwise is that almost nobody spends 9 years finding out. Here's the part I keep circling. Kotsaka posts a daily production log. Every day, the process on video. The cutting, the stacking, the fixture, work. He could keep the method opaque. Craft has a long tradition of the withheld technique, the secret that dies with the artisan, the guild that guards the recipe. Commenters are already saying these could sell for millions with the right gallery agent, which is exactly the framing that argues for secrecy. He publishes it instead. The question nobody in that thread asks, if the technique is fully visible, what exactly is the artist protecting? And the answer is nothing, because there was never anything to protect. The skill was never the secret. The secret was never the skill. Watch every frame, and you still have to put in the years. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for August 20th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quinn3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go open something up and leave the lid off the next person. We'll see you back here tomorrow.